Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me from WABE in Atlanta are Terry Onyebeni and Glenn Browder, the co-authors of a new book, South Carolina's Turkish People, A History and Ethnology. Terry and Glenn, welcome to the Journal.
Good to be here.
Thank you very much.
I think we need to start off, let's define who are the Turks of South Carolina, we really should say of Sumter County.
Okay, well, I'll take that question. We are the Turkish people of South Carolina. We believe that our progenitor is Joseph Beninhaley. He was an Ottoman Turk. And the first Beninhaley in the 1810 census, so his influence in our community has been great. And we've, through the years, survived a lot of segregation and discrimination because of the tones of our skin. But we were very proud of who we are as the Turkish people of Sumter County, South Carolina.
Okay. Could we broaden that a little bit, either historically or ethnically?
Well, the Turkish people of Sumter County, South Carolina, have a long history. But it's some call it a mysterious history or a strange history. And what makes it different is that they claim to be descended from a man of Arabic descent. But they, up until our book, had no records to or no documentation of that claim. All they had was their belief that they were descended from an Ottoman Turk.
And because of not understanding who they were or who they are throughout history, when it comes to the census, when it comes to newspaper coverage, sometimes they have been referred to as other racial, tri-racial, and some pejorative terms as well, but you cover those in your book. How did this come about? Terry, you didn't grow up in Sumter County. You grew up in Atlanta, right?
Yes, that's correct. My dad is in the Air Force, or was in the Air Force, and he met my mom in Sumter because he was stationed at Shaw Air Force Base. They met, they dated, and they married when they were teenagers. They moved around because of the military, so they lived in England, Germany, and then they came back to the United States, and they moved all over. But we finally ended up in Georgia, which is where I grew up, from the age of one. So I'm actually the only grandchild of my grandparents who was not born in Sumter. My brother was born there, and so it gives me a unique perspective on who we are. However, I always considered Sumter my second home because we went there all the time to visit my grandparents and all of my cousins and relatives. So the way that this came up is interesting, actually. Because I didn't grow up in Sumter, I grew up in Georgia. I was attending a class at Georgia State University. It was a cultural diversity class. And we were reading a book that I didn't really connect with the book, and I didn't really enjoy the book. But I'm glad that I read the book because we had a class discussion, and I said something in class one day that offended a lot of people, and I felt bad about it, and I still feel bad about it. But after I said it, my eyes were opened to the way a lot of people think. And basically what I said was that the author of the book was going on and on and on about what she had suffered and the oppression that she endured being an African-American woman. And my point that day, as ignorant as it was that, you know, that was in the past and she needed to move on. Well, what was a lively discussion in our class suddenly became a very quiet class, and all of the eyes were on me, and I knew that I had said something. But a lady across the room, she said to me, "Well, that's easy for you to say because you come from a privileged background." You know, and at the time, I didn't even know what a privileged background was. And then I started thinking, what does she mean? I started thinking about my mom's life, and she did not come from a privileged background. She had to attend a segregated school, and it's only because of her and all of the other Turkish people who came before me who fought for our rights, for equal education, that I have lived a life, I guess, of privilege. And so it turned my thinking around to how people who don't go through oppression or who are not discriminated against kind of think. They don't experience it, so they don't even know that they're privileged, and that included myself.
Glenn, you've done the historical part of this. Why don't you give us a historical perspective, starting with the patriarch, if you will, and how he ended up in Sumter County, or how you suspect he ended up in Sumter County, and kind of bring that down through almost two centuries.
First, Walter, what Terry did not explain to you is that she went from that classroom to write her doctoral dissertation on the Turkish people of Sumter County, in which she related conversations with several elderly Turkish citizens. And that's where she and I introduced ourselves to each other. As a native of Sumter, I've always been interested in the Turkish people, and I read her dissertation and called her to congratulate her. And long story short, in a couple of years, we decided that we would try to tell the full story of the Turkish people in a book. And by the way, you mentioned that they are sometimes referred to by pejorative names. The term Turk in itself, or the Turks, is rather pejorative in that it's been used over the years so many times to speak disparagingly of the citizens of this community that they don't like outsiders calling them Turks, but they acknowledge that they are descended from an Ottoman ancestor. So it's something that I think they prefer to be called Turkish people, which is the title of our book, South Carolina's Turkish People. However, you also ask about the picking this up from that original Ottoman Turk. I did the research on that, and we have studied world history during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, and we think that the original Turkish ancestor came here because of the slave trade from the Mediterranean area, the conflicts between the European Christians and the Muslims of the Middle East, and he came here to the Caribbean and eventually ended up in South Carolina, where he hooked up with General Thomas Sumter about the time of the Revolution and shortly thereafter. Thomas Sumter gave him some land near his plantation, and Joseph Benyon Haley, some say that his name was Yusuf Ben Ali, but his common name was Joseph Benyon Haley. He married a European woman and started the lineage that has lived there until today. We figured out the story of his ancestry or his patriarchal stature in this lineage. We discovered some new evidence. We discovered Thomas Sumter's legal records in which he gave land to Joseph Benyon Haley. We discovered some letters written by, curiously, the granddaughter of South Carolina's largest black slave owner. She was African-American herself, and she wrote some letters in which she told the story of Joseph Benyon Haley and how he came here and associated with General Sumter.
And
that's the kind of the origin of the that's how we trace the origins back to Joseph Benyon Haley.
All right. Well, I'm going to pick up on a couple of things. You mentioned that Joseph Benyon Haley married a European woman. So as the generations came down, there's also been a question of whether or not Native Americans figured into the family line anywhere, which I understand is still a controversial matter within the community today. Is that not
absolutely
correct?
We knew when we wrote this book that it would generate some controversy, and it sure has. Nobody that I know of claims that this was a purely Turkish community. The original patriarch married a white European woman, and a lot of white Europeans married into the lineage. Some Native Americans married into the lineage. And that's where the confusion comes in. Actually, our story is a story of four ethnic groups or racial groups in Sumter County: the Turkish people, the white Europeans, the Native Americans, and African Americans. But this certainly was a mixed lineage community.
One of the things that I think we need to mention what the Thomas Sumter did is that in a court of law, he declared that Joseph Benihaly was a Caucasian, was white. Now, in a community where the majority are African American, being declared a white person was extremely important.
It was very important. And while we were granted that from General Thomas Sumter, we didn't really enjoy all the equality that probably should have come with that. We were still discriminated against because of the color of our skin or our surnames. So there were six definite names that continued over the years that we consider to be Turkish names. Benihaly, of course, Oxendine, which is also Native American, and Buckner's and Lowry's Rays and Hoods. These are the six surnames that continuously appear on census reports, death certificates, cemetery headstones, etc.
There was discrimination, but it's also my understanding that even in the 19th century, being declared white, they were allowed to vote. Is that not correct?
That is correct. We were allowed to vote and even fight for our country. But when the men would come back from World War II and they tried to join things like the American Legion to play baseball, for example, they were denied access to these kinds of things.
Well, you mentioned the Oxendines, and of course, many people associate that name with the Lumbee Indians in that Pembroke, North Carolina area. And the Oxendines were Native American, but in Sumter County, now they consider themselves part of the Turkish people, right?
Yes.
You've already had a book signing in Sumter. I heard from someone there that it got very heated over this issue of whether or not Native Americans were part of the lineage.
It got heated and for no real purpose at all. The Oxendines, several families of partial Native American lineage married into the community, the Benihaly community, and some did not. So you can go back to that time and you can find some Oxendines who were members of the community, some who were not. The fact is that it was controversial, and in our book, we do not claim that all of these people who became part of the six families of the main families of the Turkish community, we do not claim that they were not Indians. What we do claim is they intermarried into the Benihaly lineage, and they assume the identity of being part of the Sumter County Turkish community. Yes, it was controversial. As a matter of fact, the library had a couple of uniformed officers on hand to make sure things didn't get out of hand. Unfortunately, the discussion was pretty pointed and direct at times, but it did not get out of hand.
Well, I heard that account from a descendant of General Thomas Sumter who was there, and I just thought it was a fascinating aspect of how careful people want to be about who they are and who they identify themselves as. Terry, I think in your discussion of the book, and I want to say in some way, it's one book, but it's really divided into history and then it's divided into ethnology or ethnicity. Glenn, you did the history part, and Terry, you did the ethnology part. It's interesting how in some families, in terms of Turkishness, assume the identity of the mother, which in many communities is fairly common that the child assumes the identity of the mother. But that was not used to start off with because you got your patriarch who is from the Ottoman Empire who marries a European, and the descendants actually go through both the patriarchal and the matriarchal line.
I think a proper perspective about this is to acknowledge or note that the original Ottoman Turk, whatever he did or said, we don't have a lot written about him other than his presence, but he bequeathed to his lineage a legacy of dark skin and social stigma, and that has impacted all of his lineage, whether it was someone of white European background or Native American background. It impacted them all, and they all seemed to be shaped by a nexus of patriarchy, blood, marriage, color, isolation, discrimination, and identity. And over time, if you married into the family, you normally identified with your Ottoman ancestry rather than your ancestry of one of the marrying in races or ethnic groups. Actually, to go back to what Terry said, Joseph Benyon Haley and the other gentleman who accompanied him, the man who called himself Scott, Thomas Sumter walked into the room where the jury or the court was assembled, shook hands with the two men, signifying that he considered them white, and turned to the others and said, now this is according to Thomas Sumter's great-grandson, who said that he was told this directly by a Colonel James Blanding of Sumter, that Thomas Sumter turned to the assembled white people and said, are there any questions? In other words, he was signifying, I consider these people white, so I don't think you should have any questions.
Well, I found the phrase I was looking for, a Caucasian of Arab descent.
Yes, yes. That's what General Sumter's great-grandson wrote, that this man, Joseph Benyon Haley, called himself a man, a Caucasian of Arab descent. I might also add that we were not relying simply on that. We were not relying simply on the fact that Thomas Sumter gave land to Joseph Benyon Haley. We were not relying simply on the fact that this Matilda Ellison Benyon Haley wrote letters. We actually went back and recreated the Turkish community of the 1800s, and it showed that a slight majority of them were Benyon Haleys. We also acquired about 8 results of genetic testing, which complied with a history of a progenitor of Middle Eastern, Mediterranean, North African descent with significant contributions among white Europeans and some Native American contribution to that community.
Well, I think we need to remind our listeners that why it was important for Thomas Sumter to say that, because in a state where slavery was an important part of the social and economic structure, whether or not you were considered white or black, even if you were a free person of color, like the Benyon Haley family's friends later on in the 19th century, William Ellison, they were free, but they had no civil rights. They could own property, they could not vote. But by declaring Benyon Haley a Caucasian, putting in the Arab descent, he could vote. They already had property rights, but they could vote. And as Terry pointed out, they fought with South Carolinians in the Civil War, in World War I, World War II, and Korea.
And actually fought for the South in the Confederacy, in the Civil War.
And the Revolutionary War, too.
Yes.
He's always listed as a friend or an associate of Sumter. What exactly he did in the Revolution is still kind of a mystery.
I think we were not able to solve that mystery either.
To me, the most logical one seems to have been that he was a wheelwright, so that he could keep the Sumter supply wagons in shape. And Sumter always talked about the association, but there was no documentation. He never claimed a Revolutionary War pension.
Right.
When someone like Sumter, with that kind of stature in the community, makes a statement and demonstrates it, it pretty well sets the record. You can start arguing about an Ottoman Turk, and I think you all both make a very interesting case, is he came from the Ottoman Empire, but he probably was from North Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, somewhere along in there, right?
Yes. You know, Walter, you mentioned that Thomas Sumter kind of blessed Joseph Benyon Haley as being a white man, and that carried a certain amount of acceptance, but not total acceptance in the South. Ironically, William Ellison, whom you've mentioned, was considered the largest black slave owner in South Carolina, he did not want his children dating the Turks. And when one of his granddaughters actually married a Turkish citizen, one of Joseph Beninhale's descendants, the Ellison family cut her off from the family and the family fortune.
That was Matilda, correct?
Yes.
That's Matilda.
The Ellisons are a very interesting family in their own right.
You all use this correspondence in which the Beninhales are mentioned in the Ellison family letters, No Chariot Let Down, which was published back in the 80s. So at least there was an economic interaction. The biographers, or two of them, of William Ellison seem to indicate that there was also social interaction. I got the idea that the free persons who were in a world in shadow, as were the Turkish people, somehow had some interaction. Now, maybe if I've got that wrong, please correct me.
Now, I think you're right. William Ellison, the head of the black family, was really in an awkward position. He could not associate very closely with the whites, but he absolutely would not associate with the slaves, with the black slaves. There was some interaction with the Turkish people, but not anything of any great extent, because he could not afford to be associated with either black slaves or the dark-skinned Turkish people. Now, obviously, there was some interaction because he had, a child or two grandchildren who married outside of their race, but they had nobody else to marry other than somebody in Charleston. So he was in a very awkward position, but there was some interaction between the Ellison family and both Thomas Sumter's family and the Beninhale family.
Well, you raised an interesting question, because one of the tales that's always been about the Turkish people is they always intermarried. Well, they kind of had to, right?
Absolutely.
That's true. But if you think about other ethnic groups intermarrying, that's not a big deal. The reason it was such a big deal in the Turkish community was because it was a pretty small community. And that's also the reason the names continued to repeat. But as I talked to my participants in the study, what they would tell me about that is they couldn't date outside of the ethnic group because nobody would date them.
Actually, in many rural communities across the country, and especially in the American South, cousins marrying cousins, it's not anything unusual. It's not something that's simply confined to the Turkish people. I can show you genealogies that look like bowls of spaghetti of the cousins marrying cousins. But that's one thing that I'm very interested in the way you all would take perceptions handed down, and you would kind of reply to those or answer those or, in some cases, dismiss them. But you did your research on what people over time have talked about as what John Shelton Reed referred to as these odd enclaves on the southern ethnological landscape.
Yes, and one of the participants of the study said that the opportunity that the Turkish people had to date outside of the ethnic group was when Shaw Air Force Base came in, because people outside of the Dazelle area didn't know anything about the Turkish community, and so they were able to date, which is how my mom and dad married.
We've talked about race relations. There's a very interesting part of the Turkish people's story, and that is they're protesting about segregation beginning in the 1930s and actually achieving, in terms of the schools in Sumter County, integration before African Americans did. A lot of that, Terry, is a part of your story. So why don't we talk about the schools for the Turkish people?
Sure. The Dazelle School for Turkish People, well, there were many. One, and I think it was 1913, had 28 students and one teacher. And then there were two schools later in 1928, one in Stateburg and one in Dazelle with two teachers. And then in 1934, the Turkish people came together and they asked to be admitted into the white schools, and they were denied. So the Dazzle School for Turks was built and constructed for the Turkish students in 1935, and it served them until the 1961, I believe, is when the elementary school students were allowed to attend. Now, the high school students were able to attend white schools earlier than the Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. They actually integrated, I think, in 1950. I know one of my participants graduated from Hillcrest in 1953.
You mentioned that several children of Turkish descent in the town of Sumter moved there. Their going into the Sumter High School was not a problem. It was in the rural community, where you talk about Hillcrest and Dalzell, where it took more of a push, and not everybody's experience was positive. And you cite your mom or your grandmom in that.
Yes, of the four participants, one attended Edmonds High School, as you said, in the city. He had no problems at all. The football coach came out and asked him to join the team. The teachers and the students were all very encouraging to him, inviting him to, you know, to do things and take classes. He just wasn't prepared to succeed at that school, but he had no problems with anyone. He said there was one incident at school where a boy said something, and he just told him how it was going to be, and there was nothing else. And another incident at Edmonds was just a girl at the bus stop not wanting to get off of the bus with him or be seen with him or be anywhere near him. Now, the other three participants attended Hillcrest School, High School, and they had a terrible experience. They were afraid. They were bullied. People called them names. And it was actually violent. And I have a lot of stories I could tell you about some of the things that they endured at that school that shouldn't have happened. For example, one of my participants, Helen, talked about even the teachers were involved. They would not call the Turkish people by name, but rather say things like, "You people over there need to speak up." The ladies in the cafeteria would push the choice pieces of chicken aside. The bus driver would jerk the bus to make them fall and tell people not to let them sit down. Boys would elbow them as they tried to enter the cafeteria, throw oranges and apples at them. And they just said it was a very scary experience. If you think about it, my relatives who attended these schools were pioneers, agents of change, whereas in Little Rock and Selma and Montgomery, every moment of that integration was recorded for the world to see their achievements and celebrate with them. The Turkish people of Sumter County did not have that. No one ever celebrated or commemorated their triumphs or their history.
Now, those three students at Hillcrest were all young girls, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Did they graduate from high school?
One of the three graduated. She was one of two who graduated from Hillcrest in 1953. She said it was a horrible experience. When they graduated, one of the Turkish girls was actually wearing the same dress as a white student. The white girl was offended. She went home and changed her clothes. It was just little things like that. Well, big things like that is what I should say.
Since the 1950s, we've got the example of your parents, your mother getting married, moving out of the community. In your portion of the book, Terry, you're very concerned about the future of the Turkish community in Sumter County.
Yes, it's a fading community now. We still have rich heritage, and there still is a Turkish community that's vibrant. But because of people marrying people of other ethnic groups, and obviously the fact that segregation is no longer legal, thank goodness, but things like that keep a group together for so long, these things don't exist. And the younger groups coming up, sometimes they don't understand what those who came before us had to endure. We're just concerned that we want the younger people to know exactly what we went through. I should say they went through, because I didn't go through that, but I know their stories.
All right, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Terry Onyebany and Glenn Browder about their book, South Carolina's Turkish People, and we're talking about the Turkish people of Sumter County. Glenn, you're from Sumter. You got your degree at Emory, and then you taught at Jacksonville State
Yes. I went to Edmonds High School, graduated from Edmonds, and then went to Presbyterian College, and then after that to Emory University.
In doing your research, what were some of the most interesting things, that nuggets that you discovered that weren't even part of the mythology and misconceptions out there?
Well, I think the story of Matilda Ellison Bennett Haley, is probably the most interesting subplot of this story, because she married into the Turkish community. She had no children, so she didn't contribute anything to the bloodline. But her letters have been absolutely critical to us understanding the situation. The fact is, our state was much richer in its culture and its society than we tend to think sometimes. We generally think in terms of the black-white binary situation. But her story illustrates the complexity and the richness of Southern history.
Where did you uncover her letters?
That's another interesting story. The Turkish people have always been very reclusive. They did not trust outsiders, because outsiders, especially journalists, would come in and ask them questions, and then would go out and denigrate their oral history and make fun of them. So they did not like to talk to outsiders. The only reason Terry and I were able to get in was because she was a Turkish descendant and I was with her. We found an individual who said that these letters had been passed down from one Ben and Haley to another over the generations. And the last generation, a gentleman who had served in the U.S. Navy in World War II, had these letters. And we obtained copies, photographed copies, of the letters, along with other photographs and other items that had been hoarded and cherished among the Turkish people for generations.
In your research, you came up with quotations from all sorts of folks, from Herbert Ravenel Sass to Ebony Magazine, and their miscalculation or their misdescription of the Turkish people. And I just need to read one of these passages because it's incredible. And this is from Charlestonian Herbert Ravenel Sass. It was a book called The South Carolina Low Country. And this is in the mid-50s. He speculated that the Turkish people originated from, and I quote, slender, raven-haired, golden-skinned creatures stolen by pirates at the Red Sea, as the Red Sea men from nobles of the great mogul's Delhi court, who were on a pilgrimage to Mecca and brought to South Carolina 3 centuries ago. Almost as curious and somewhat ironically, Ebony Magazine called the Dalzell group a raceless people, and this is in 1957, distrusted by both whites and blacks. And that wasn't the only time that Ebony Magazine, predominantly African-American journal, one of the important ones of the 1950s, made negative comments about the Turks.
Yes, there have been many fantastical stories told about the Turks, the Sumter Turks, and it's strange that they never could say anything, because they didn't know and had no documentation about their history until our research came along.
I guess one of the most favorable stories, of course, was by Thomas Sebastian Sumter, great-grandson. He's the one who really documented for the first time the Joseph Bennett Haley story.
Yes. And he wrote his documentation of that story and the history of the Turkish people. He specifically said, because this was in about 1917, many of these young men have fought for our country over generations, and now they're going off to World War I to fight for us again. And they deserve to know and be able to tell other people about who they are.
Many of the commentators from outside refer to the Turkish people as not joyful, quiet. And I think, Terry, you addressed this because they just didn't trust outsiders. They weren't going to speak when journalists would come or any outsider, right?
Well, that's somewhat true because of things that had happened in the past where when they actually did open up to journalists or, I should say it this way, when they didn't talk to journalists, journalists would just say what they thought without getting information from them. But I guess when you've been slighted enough and you don't trust someone, you don't really want to chit-chat with them either.
Yeah, I mean, it's... And whether you're talking about someone like Ann King Gregory, who was, for her day, a very respected historian, history of Sumter County in the 1950s, Cassie Nichols, who taught in the Sumter County schools for years and did historical sketches of Sumter County, they talk about the fatalism of the Turkish people. And this is from Ann King Gregory. Always a law-abiding people, the Turks of Sumter County are said to be singularly lacking in spontaneous joy. They wear, one and all, the air of patient and unquestioning acceptance of life as they find it. Now, your work tells something different.
Yes, that's true. I would also like to just bring up Paulo Freire's work about pedagogy of the oppressed, where the oppressed people in the beginning of they go through stages, and the first stage is just acceptance, like, okay, what can we do about this? You know, we're not part of society as we want to be, and they just kind of accept it. And then that might be the stage many Turkish people were in when people wrote those kinds of things. However, as time goes on and you start seeing how things can be and you start reflecting on it, there comes a time where the Turkish people come together and say, well, we can change this. And that's when a lot of the heroes of the Turkish community came together to fight for our rights. And my participants named them as Henry Benin Haley and Woodrow Hood and Marion Hood and Henry Ray and Herbert Ray and just a lot of other people who came together because they were ready to fight for their rights, and they did.
Terry, you might want to also mention that this is the first time that the Turkish people have had a chance to tell their story.
That's true, because they wouldn't open up to outsiders. But because I am Turkish and my mom is still in the community, they trusted that they could tell me their stories and that I would, you know, do some member checks to make sure that I was quoting them accurately, which I have done. And not only have I interviewed the people who endured the integration movement, but we've actually interviewed some Turkish people who are younger, who are in the community today. And life for them is a lot different. It's joyful even, you know. So if those same reporters who wrote a long time ago about the fatalistic attitudes of the Turkish people and, you know, they won't smile and they isolate themselves, nowadays, if they were to interview the Turkish people today, they would see a totally different group of people, and it's because we're not living, you know, in an oppressed society like we were back then.
We earlier mentioned the fact that the Turkish community in Sumter County, centered around Stateburg, Dalzell, that area, is beginning to dissipate, and being in that area geographically has, I think, help, you know, focus the identity. Are there people living in Denver or San Francisco or New York City who are Turkish people who claim to be Turkish people, or has that disappeared when they're no longer part of the geographic community?
I can actually answer that on a personal note. Being a Turkish person and living in Atlanta is nothing like being a Turkish person and living in South Carolina, especially, you know, years ago. I am Turkish. I claim that, and I'm proud of that. I haven't experienced what they've experienced, but as far as those other places that you mentioned, I really doubt it, unless they're from Sumter and they've grown up there and they've endured what my people have endured. Then I don't know. I don't think so.
so as young people move out, they're losing their Turkish person identity. Is that what you're saying?
Unfortunately, that is true, yes. And so that's why I'm hoping that this book will help the Turkish people, especially young people, remember our roots, where we came from, but not let the pains of the past dictate our future.
Okay.
Walter, one of our fondest memories is we were both sitting with a a gentleman who was in his 40s, a Turkish descendant, interviewing him for our book. And he called in his daughter, a 12-year-old young lady, a beautiful young lady, and said, asked her to listen to this. And he thanked us tremendously and said that he was so happy to see the Turkish story being told and being told by Turkish people, because he had always wanted to be able to tell his daughter where she came from or who her people were, and he did not know how. And so hopefully younger people who are now in the mainstream of society and are enjoying a better life in the 21st century of Turkish descent will have this to help them understand where they come from.
Well, in reading, and this, again, Terry, is in your portion of the book, which includes the interviews, I could hear echoes that I have heard from individuals, primarily African Americans, of the Sea Islands as the Gullah communities, the younger generations, move up. Mm-hmm. They lose the accent. They forget about traditional crafts, and they move to the big city. And again, you're talking about something experienced. They didn't experience what their parents or grandparents had experienced.
That's correct. And so I think it's important that they remember their past, just like the African-American community. They've moved beyond a lot of the oppression that they endured also, but it's important to remember that, you know, for the future. We have to remember the past.
William Faulkner said the past has never passed, particularly here in the South. But in terms of 21st century Sumter, and I'm looking at the individuals that you have interviewed and what they're doing, they seem to have integrated themselves into mainstream Sumter. They're educators, they're businessmen and women. Is that pretty much accurate?
Oh, that's definitely accurate. We're professionals. We're ordinary people. We live all over the world, you know. We have pretty much assimilated into mainstream society, and that's a really great thing for us. The only drawback, though, is, you know, we're losing our identity because of it, which is what we're trying to prevent.
Glenn, I particularly enjoyed your description of the pre-Civil War, the Baptist Church in the High Hills, that beautiful old sanctuary where the white members sat on one side, the Turkish people sat on the other side, and the enslaved people sat in the balcony.
That's an interesting scene to think about. But, you know, that's the way it was. And hopefully we've learned a lot from just imagining that scene.
Well, Terry, how do Turkish people describe themselves in the census these days when race is asked?
We, generally speaking, of course, I can't speak for everyone who's Turkish. We identify ourselves as white on the census report.
Okay. And in the census over time, and Glenn, this is something you found, in one census an individual might be labeled as white. 10 years later, he might be described as mulatto. Another 10 years later, he's back being white.
Yes, that's a curiosity that shows the, I guess, the racial character, the racism of a lot of institutions, especially back in the day, because those designations quite often were not self-descriptions, but it was up to the person taking the census. And the person taking the census would go to a household and might categorize one person as Turk and another person as African and another person as mulatto. It was up to them to do that. As a matter of fact, we recount instances where the people when they gave birth to a hospital in Sumter, one child would be labeled black, another child later on would be called Turk, or it would vary, have siblings who were labeled by different designations, and that's because the people filling out the forms would make their own judgment according to the tone of the child's skin.
And in the days of segregation, the hospital in Sumter had three separate wards, right? White, black, and
yes.
Turk.
Yes, yes, they did. And the people that Terry interviewed have recounted nightmares about how they had to fight to make sure that their children were designated appropriately.
You'd had, what, 8 DNA samples? You went to 8 different individuals?
Yes. Yes.
Did that cover all of the family names?
No, it did not. Common practice in literature and in research is not to release the names of the people involved in those. But we had reports from 8 different individuals of different names, but it did not cover all of the names. And the results generally, as I've said, complied with the notion of somebody from the Mediterranean, Middle East, North African area with a lot of white European in admixture and also Native American admixture.
Well, that high percentage of what I think they call North African markers gives a great deal of credence to the Joseph Benihaly story.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. That was kind of the capping of the several steps that we went about confirming the traditional narrative of being descended from a Caucasian of Arab descent.
All right. I hate to do this, but Alfred's given me the wind-up sign. And so I'm going to ask each of you to have some last words for our listeners. And Terry, I'll start with you.
Okay. I would like to end with how we ended the book, which was a council of the elders. We had the great-great-great-grandsons of both General Thomas Sumter and our patriarch Joseph Benihaly give us their opinions about the Turkish community. And Thomas Sumter Tinsdale Jr., who's a lawyer, he was saying that the Turkish people, it's been long coming, but the Turkish people's history needs to be woven into American history. We've been completely neglected in American history, and he's saying it's about time because we have contributed a lot to the county, the state, in Southern history, and of course the country. And then Dr. Eliezer Benihaly said that the things that we endured, even though we've endured a lot, I'm still very proud to be an American, and we need to use the pains of the past as stepping stones toward the future.
Okay. Glenn?
I think the lesson that I would draw from our research in this book is that sometimes for some people, the journey towards being part of America, to being an American, is a long and difficult ordeal. However, what we have shown, and is evidenced by the Turkish community today, it is a better world in the 21st century. And I would say simply that perhaps we all should celebrate our ancestors and understand that we're all part of the same family.
All right. Well, Terry Ann Onyebeni and Glenn Browder, co-authors of South Carolina's Turkish People, A History and Ethnology, thank you so much for being with us today on the Journal.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's Journal. The story of the Turkish people of Sumter County has for centuries been some myth, some reality, a world in shadow. From whence do these people come? Through their research, Terri-Ann Onyebany and Glenn Browder have contributed a lot to our knowledge of these people and their place in South Carolina history and society. For generations, the Turkish people were considered white enough to vote, but not white enough to attend the schools of Sumter County. Yet, through concerted community effort, by 1950, children of the Turkish people were attending white schools in Sumter. This is a decade before the first African-American children are attending white schools in South Carolina. So there was more than one fight for integration and educational equality in South Carolina. It wasn't just a story of African-American and white. You've got the Turkish people who were considered an other, but who also had a story to tell. And one of the elders of the Turkish people said recently, "The good experiences of being born in Sumter County outweigh the bad. Let's use the pains of the past as stepping stones to the future. As citizens and past citizens of Sumter, let's join hands and hearts together to make Sumter a better place where everyone, no matter the background, can live with dignity and respect." This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.